From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? I find myself at the tail end of a somewhat frantic journey from Zurich to the United States, and a journey which I made with some ease, but my luggage unfortunately failed to replicate my style and my arrival. So I'm dressed like a drive-by outside the Goodwill shop. But joining me, far more sartorially eloquent, I'm sure, is the captain, Giles Morgan. Giles, where are you?
I'm back in Wandsworth. No glamour trips for me, I'm afraid, this week. No, I'm just keeping Southwest London honest.
Attaboy. Well, listen, many have tried. None have yet to succeed.
I can actually see the floodlights of your favourite football club just around the bend on the River Thames at Fulham.
Bless them. Bless them. A little piece of me will always be at Craven Cottage, no matter where I am in the world. And the same goes for my suitcase, I'm sure. Roger, joining us, as always, from whence this week?
I think it's Como, but the rain has been so bad here. You may have seen Venice. I still think it's the Como, although I'm looking at the water levels as this podcast continues. I'll be very, very careful.
Now, see, if we're all quiet and we listen very, very carefully, we should be able to hear the complete lack of sympathy from the audience, Roger, that it's raining in Lake Como. Yeah, there we go.
There you go. My sympathy about your bags is just out the window. No chance.
Well, gentlemen, look, we have another fantastic guest coming up shortly, who I'm going to leave for you, Roger, to introduce. But before we do, boy, do we have a lot to talk about this week in the world of sports. I'm going to kick off because I must admit it appalled and really did surprise me, and that was the reception that poor Joe Gomez got for England at Wembley the other night. You know, we all saw the nonsense with the fight between him and Sterling, which, look, I mean, you've got young, testosterone-fueled sportsmen, ultimate competitors. Of course, there's going to be a few handbags every now and again, but the fact that this thing got blown up the way it did, is utterly ridiculous in my point. And it just shows you how desperate today's journalists are to get a story of some sort. I thought, you know, Sterling, having been a total dick in how he started the whole thing, handled the aftermath extremely well, took it on his shoulders, took his punishment like a man, stepped up to the plate and sort of defended Joe Gomez after the event. But, you know, the crowd, it's just, Roger, honestly, it reaffirms a lot of what you've said, supposedly controversially, about the average soccer fan. And I have to say, it made me feel sick to my stomach to see that.
Yes, I will say before we start that I am now a new person and I will not be any more chippy or controversial. I have seen the light. The spirituality is flowing through me and it's all good. In this case, if I have to, I would say that Southgate would be the target of my disapproval. These things happen all the time in football. Only by sending somebody home does it ever come out. If this was happening every single time these occurrences took place, then half the team would be sitting on the couch on a Saturday. Football's like that. I'm not sure I've got a lot to say. I'm not sure I'm a super fan of Southgate. I know most people are. I just think he's trying too hard in a lot of ways to cut this new type of like image. Sterling, I must admit, I've never liked. I'll be very honest about that, since the days he agitated for a move away from Liverpool. So I don't know what he expected, really. And as I said the other day, I really like Joe Gomez. You know, I come from the country of great defenders, and I've just got my eye on this boy. I think he could be, together with Van Dijk, a Laurinson-Hansen-type partnership, and could be the centre-half that England have been looking for. So those fans will probably regret this.
Yeah, and I just sort of I just jump in here is that I'm slightly with you, Grant. This is media bollocks, right? Sports, exactly. Team sports have always had people fighting, clashing, making up, being brilliant sports people together, they're not. And that's what dressing rooms are all about. And it should never have gone anywhere near the media, all of this. And it's a non-story. And it really, and then for the crowd to react, because we now work, well, we live in a world where journalists are not actually reporting. They're simply, it's conjecture. And it's I find it very depressing. Christ, most of the time I played rugby with everyone I played rugby. And I'm talking for Shitville United 15. I mean, if I wasn't in a fight with someone in my own team, it wasn't a Saturday.
But Giles, in fairness, that's just because nobody likes you. I mean, there was that, of course.
Well, it is that thing. It just saves time. People take an instant dislike to me.
But it's funny what you said there. What both of you said there. I think Roger, when you talked about Southgate letting this out, I think that's the problem. I think Southgate has to let it out because leaks occur, and back in the day, the leaks would have occurred, and the press would have gone, who cares? I mean, to Giles's point, it's just a couple of guys having handbags. This isn't a story. But now it is. The leaks are still going to occur, and when the leaks do, and it is confidential inside information from the camp, it would have got blown up even more. So, I mean, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think it's utter rubbish, but I think if any phrase captured it in its essence, I think Giles's media bollocks is spot on.
Yeah, perfect, Giles.
Yeah, well, it's the only erudition you'll get from me today, so enjoy.
Anything else that's caught your eye this week, fellas, before we bring our guest on?
Yeah, well, this one, I've been quite interested in the tennis, actually. I think the ATP finals. Yes. I'm being quite interested that it just may be that we're at the start of the new dawn of the men's tennis domination, where, you know, we've seen for whatever it is, 18 years, the big
37 three. 37 years, yeah.
whatever it's been since 1893. But, you know, obviously the big three of Federer, Nadal and Djokovic have dominated everything. And whilst this wasn't a slam and the ATP is the end of season finale, but I'm just interested that we didn't have a final with any of those three or, of course, Andy Murray in it. And just it may be we're on the cusp of a new world order, or not world order, but the new cast. And I'm quite excited for the game because it's inevitable that generationally there's going to be a retirement of the big three, and maybe these boys are beginning to step up.
It's funny. I was in Switzerland this week, and I was going to ask you what happened because I read in the Swiss press about Federer's match with Djokovic, but it was in German, and I'm going back to my school days, I was pretty sure there was a lot of Geschmunchen and Geschmacken and Getrinken, but I'm fairly certain that he beat Djokovic. Would I be right in assuming that?
Yes.
Excellent. Good. Well, I'm a huge Federer fan, as we've discussed.
And thank God for your German.
Yes, he did. and then he lost, and Tsitsipas went on to win and against Thiem. And it's just interesting to me. I mean, they've got a lot of work to do, these young boys, because they've been eclipsed by the big three for so long. But every generation has new stars, and there was a time, I mean, goodness, when Federer started, he was virtually booted off. He was a firebrand. He wasn't the cool customer we know him to be. And maybe it's just always interesting to note moments in time. And this just may be a moment, so November 2019, where we started to see the glimpses of the new order, which I think is interesting for tennis.
Well, of course, Federer also had a ponytail in those days, which I think is it was a bit bigger sin.
Yeah, he actually looked, I'll tell you what, that ponytail looked a little bit like Francis Rossi's for a while in the 70s for exactly status quo right. Fans.
Googling status ququo.
Yeah, there you go. Rog, anything caught your eye?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to mention the tennis because I said in a couple of episodes that for me, tennis died in Wimbledon this year, and I'm going to hold to that. I wasn't even aware that the ATPs were on. But you know, anyway, that's just me. The thing that I was looking at following on from our discussions about Sarrazins is the eruption that's about to come out of UEFA regarding Man City and financial fair play. My understanding is that Man City and all the wealth that they are putting at their disposal, as well as some very, very hairy corporate pit bulls, is shaking UEFA. And I think they are going to tend to back down. I'm led to believe that some of the people on the FFP subcommittee of UEFA are not going to be able to keep their position because of this and will resign. Similar to the way that Brian Quinn resigned in an earlier version of this. So what I think we're going to see here on the back of Saracens is Man City probably winning this because they're just too big and too hairy. And I believe UEFA have already spent millions in legal fees on this. And then that's going to put the whole world of FFP in some state of flux. So that's one I would ask you all to watch over the next 4 to 6 weeks.
All right, fair enough. Consider everybody's cards well and truly marked. And I know a certain formerly chippy Scotsman that is no doubt going to keep us up to date on that thing as it develops. Well, look, that brings us round to the point where we really need to introduce our guest this week, who I think the three of us have been champing at the bit for this one. So, Rog, why don't you let everybody know?
I'd like Giles to do it because
all right, let the captain do it.
Let's let the captain do it.
Okay, well, it is a great joy, personal joy for me to welcome Andy Southerden, also known as the Nugget, for sort of his diminutive stature in goal for various Kent football teams that I think he plays for. He is a man who's been in the sports marketing industry for nearly as long as Federer has been world number one. But I mean, Andy's small, certainly, but he must be at least 50, 51. He for a long time worked for the WPP Group, with Hill & Knowlton running their international sports division, which for those of you who don't know what that means is he's basically the clever guy behind a lot of big sponsors and what they do and how they get their pound of flesh from sponsorship. He now is international head of brand consulting at CAA, which is one of the world's largest sports marketing companies. And I suspect is in that kind of dark arts of twisting communication, finding new ways for sponsors to weave their tricks. I know that a little bit because he did most of my tricks for HSBC for a long time. So Andy Southerden, a man not short of words, although short, a very welcome guest. Andy, it's the captain here. How are you doing, sir?
Captain, very good order. Thank you. How are you?
Are you in Kent today or are you in Hammersmith?
No, well, if you open your window and shout loud enough, I might be able to hear you. I'm in Hammersmith.
Actually, I can see you, although you are diminutive. So are you standing on a chair?
We're going to have an hour of this, aren't we? Marvellous.
No, yeah. I get this all the time. All the time. Just ignore them.
Listen, well, I'm in the 5-7 club, Roger.
Andy, you're very welcome to the show, and I'll introduce you obviously to Roger and to Grant. We're really looking forward to having you on the show. We want you to get on the soapbox, one, so we can see you, and secondly, so
unbelievable.
Andy, I would like to say, Andy, that you have a supporter and a Batman in me. I will not lower myself to any of this sort of nonsense.
Unbelievable.
I'd love to say this is a new chap from Morgan, but sadly, this is at least 12 years old. I never mind. Yeah,
and tell me, what have you been up to? I mean, you're now at the mighty CAA, part of one of the global sort of conglomerates, sort of weaving great things out of the sports and sponsorship world. How's it going in the new gig, and what are you up to?
Well, I'm known as a creative artist now. How about that?
Good Lord. My God.
No, enjoying it enormously. I was 17 years at the previous place and 6 months into this one. So they haven't found me out yet, but I'm having a lot of fun. They know the industry, and beautifully for me, they know much more beyond the sports world as well. So the main reason that I came here is that the opening up of the wider world of entertainment was important to me, because it's all beautifully integrated, isn't it? So they're doing rather well, and I'm enjoying every moment.
Andy, you know, I come from the music business, and I've now moved into sport, and I look at all, I've got this thing about comparing where sport is going as to where music has been, and where Hollywood is now evolving to, and the polarization. One of the things that caught my eye is this: you guys are owned by private equity now. And what caught my eye over the weekend was that really interesting story about Taylor Swift, which has got nothing to do with sport, but I think leads us into what we can put under the theme of how does private equity operate. So for those that don't know, Taylor Swift sold her company to private equity a while ago, and all of a sudden now seems to realize that she is now no longer in control of the copyright of her songs, and is squealing and bitching on social media accordingly. So tell me a little bit, as a way to understand how CEA operates in sport now, what does that kind of shareholding mean, and what do you think it will mean for sport in general as it becomes more and more prevalent?
Well, CAA represents a whole array of different talents, and sometimes, like Lady Gaga, they'll advise on a cosmetics range that they will license under her name exclusively. Sometimes they will put her into a business and she's a special advisor. All of the time, the maintenance of their own identity and copyright is important, and the Taylor Swift story is smacks of irony to some degree. I'm very happy to take the money and then squeal somewhere down the line, but it's not work that I'm familiar with here at CAA, and certainly the football talents, the sports talents at large, I haven't heard of any sort of private equity model moving in to overtake any of the assets that the clients within CAA enjoy.
And do you think, you know, even as we speak, we see that CVC have expanded their rugby profile to the Pro 14 today. We had Mark Oliver on, and we talked a little bit about how sport needs this capital to evolve its model, when you've got people like Disney with all the funds and ATT with all the funds doing it quite aggressively. Sport needs that new capital. The obvious person is private equity. How much do you see private equity really shaking up the old boardrooms and old clubhouses up and down the world of sport?
It has to be refreshing. I mean, a new voice breaking into traditional chambers, where a different point of view is being expressed, sometimes from a fan's perspective, sometimes from a pure business perspective. Any change has got to be perceived as good, so long as the person chairing how the money is brought in and then dispersed has the interests of the game and the fan at heart. And sometimes I worry about some private equity coming in with slightly ulterior motives, because I'm certainly like you gentlemen of the mind that unless the sport, unless the fan is put first, the money can sometimes be ill spent. But I think whether it's broadcast revenue, whether it's revenue sourced through commercial sponsorship, I think the well now needs to be so deep. A diversified means of attracting money is always going to be important. So private equity is I think it's here for the longer term. It's a question of how much more of it we'll see as a trend going forward.
I think the great danger of private equity, of course, and it is your, I agree with you, it's a necessary part of finding new capital to grow and develop sports and to find new audiences. I think the great fear that anyone has with private equity is that by definition, private equity has to exit at some point. And depending on that exit point can mean that the humble fan is the one that it is shafted. So I think you're right. I think with caution, we should embrace the CVCs, et cetera, because it's going to help shake up the product, and rugby certainly needs the capital in this case. We just hope that the people who've got their hand on the tiller are people who have got a responsibility that without the fan, there is no sport.
Well, let me just add to that, because, Giles, you bring up the exit, and this is obviously something very important for the likes of private equity firms going into this. I mean, they'll have a clear idea of A, what kind of exit they're looking for, what kind of valuation, and probably at this point they'll have a good sense of the kind of people / organizations that this would appeal to once they've sprinkled their fairy dust on it. What do you think is the exit here? Because it seems to me that private equity buying into sport is almost towards the end of a cycle. I mean, we've had community-owned clubs going to local businessmen-owned clubs with local directors and people that grew up in the village and wanted to own a piece of that club, to sometimes multinational corporations, to oligarchs. Now we're going to private equity. And I struggle to see who private equity thinks they're going to sell these clubs onto.
Well, I agree. I think that is the big worry. What is the exit? And yeah. So in the short term, and even if you take a 7, 8, 9 year private equity investment, as you say, at some point there has to be someone to pass this on to. I have a feeling that rugby, because it looks at CVC are trying to take on pretty much the whole sport, that maybe that will create enough of a power platform that someone can invest and take it forward. But
That's what happened in Formula One.
Exactly.
CVC to Liberty.
Exactly. And I think that has to be their play. But in other terms, examples where private equity come in on something which is less strategic and more looks like a vanity play, I think it can often end in disaster. And there will be football clubs in the future who I suspect will be in that position.
Andy, can I take this back from the sort of macro sport level down to the individual level? Because it's something I'd love to talk to you about, and that is your involvement with what really, to me as an Englishman, was the first real creation of a global superstar based on the sports business, and that's David Beckham. Here was a guy that had a tremendous profile in the UK. Let's face it, some of it extremely bad, went through some extremely tough experiences, but he became a global icon, which I have to say, as talented as he was, I think the level of his fame far surpassed his talent on the football pitch. And I'm just interested into hearing that story, that journey from the other side, from the people that actually helped create that persona.
Well, the Gillette example was born out of a new guy arriving in a new job and giving himself a small window of opportunity to ask all of the silly questions. And the silly question I asked myself and eventually the guys at Gillette was, is there a physical person that represents the best the man can get? Because I've grown up with that as one of the world's most famous slogans.
Yeah.
And is there an individual that personifies that perfectly? Because all I see is a jet fighter pilot who has his very smooth cheek longingly stroked by adorable women. And I'm not so sure I can relate to that kind of presentation of the best the man can get. Is there not an individual who I might relate to as a guy in his sort of 20s, 30s, who might be more appropriate? And story short, Beckham's name came up. And at the time, known as Golden Balls, he was one of the few players that genuinely transcended the sport. He was in love with a Spice Girl. In fact, Gillette, based in Boston, wondered whether Beckham was indeed the husband of a Spice Girl. They didn't know him particularly well. And I think it was really all about the insight that in China, if David Beckham turned up with a marble, they would buy marbles. And it just so happens right. In China, most men use electric shavers. So without getting into the boring detail as to how facial hair grows in that part of the world, David Beckham encouraging men to wet shave rather than electric shave was basically going to be the ROI within months, let alone years. So the insight really was the celebrity of Beckham, his ability to work way beyond the 90 minutes. He was a fashion icon. He was a style icon, from sarongs to hairstyles. He was genuinely an individual that guys loved. Women loved him even more. Young boys wanted to be him. Young girls fancied him and had his poster up on their bedroom walls. So in Gillette, yes, it was their first global face, but more importantly, it was the moment when they realized that actually using an individual like him to emotionally engage with their audience rather than telling them how sharp and how close their shave would be was a bit of a game changer for them. And you add to that the China dynamic, and it was a tremendous signing. And in my view, it ended too quickly. It was a shame that it ended 3 years into the endorsement, because he'd just gone to the States. And I remember saying at the time that it was a shame that they didn't continue with that endorsement, because it was a reminder to any company getting involved in endorsement deals and sponsorships that it's really the emotional engagement that any partnership can provide that will, if you get it right, reinvent your company in the minds and hearts of the consumer, whether it's a current consumer or whether it's a prospective consumer. And I think Beckham at the time, he was doing the chat shows, he was doing the catwalks, he had a wife that was at the top of her game from a fashion perspective. So he had it all going for him. So the company that had traded in football for a long time, they'd been World Cup sponsors for years. Gillette Soccer Saturday was very much part of the furniture of a Saturday afternoon for any football fan like me. So they were very much within the fabric of football, but they lacked somehow an individual to carry that torch forward. And Beckham was that individual. He did tremendously well for them.
And Andy, just let me ask you, I hate to hog the mic, and I'll let the others have a turn, but I find this fascinating. Yeah. With regards to Beckham particularly, I mean, obviously the marketer's job is to create the impression of someone, a rounded impression, who is the kind of person, to your point, that everybody and every demographic wants to be, marry, whatever it may be. I know plenty of people who've met Beckham, spent time with him, and the feedback I get is always the same, which is he really is a genuinely good guy, and a lot of what you see when in the media is actually genuine, that he is that kind of guy. But there must be a point where, as marketers, you have to work with people who aren't like that. How do you deal with it? How do you deal with trying to create a global icon from someone who, frankly, is a bit of a dickhead?
Well,
are you talking about Roger?
No, I'm not, because we already, Giles, we've spoken about this. We already have a plan about how to make him a global icon.
Oh, that's right. Plan B.
Well, but certainly Beckham was no dickhead. He knew exactly how to present himself and market himself. The brains behind that marketing machine was his wife. In fact, he was very self-aware of his look. He photographed beautifully. He filmed beautifully. When he spoke, let's be honest, it was more the look than his own narrative. But actually, he's grown into being much more fluent and compelling as a commentator. I like the work that he's doing in Miami. But to answer your question, Grant, I think it always goes back to what the company needs from that individual or from any endorsement. If I need you to look good, then I don't need you to say very much. I just need you to look tremendous in front of a camera, and be at my point of sale, be in my advertising. I don't need to script you one iota. But there are other endorsements where it's less about the look and it's more about the compelling narrative that that individual can carry on your company's behalf. Are you going to be very fluent? And many of the female soccer players, for example, remarkably articulate. And I've had the pleasure of working with many guys who wouldn't look so good in front of a camera, but my goodness, they are a tremendous ambassador for the intellectual side of the business. And Gillette was all about looking good and feeling good. So do we need Beckham to say much? Not really. We needed him to look damn good in front of a camera, and he did. And he sold razor blades by the ton. So different companies, different strokes. And I think the Beckham example with Gillette is one of the first. We all go back long enough to remember Henry Cooper and what he did. What your hero did, Mr. George Best. He had his own endorsement deals. So I think it always goes back to what the company is trying to achieve from any said endorsement.
Andy, sort of segue into this, talking about celebrity and sport and entertainment. And as you say, this is not new. I think this goes back many, many years. But we're seeing a new dawn. And if we take the world of boxing now, what are your thoughts on Logan Paul, KSI, what's happening in boxing, where you've got people who are not traditional boxers who have created, I guess, a new spectacle, a new entertainment, which seems to be turning the boxing world on its head. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I was like Roger. I got up at 5 o'clock and sat there for an hour and a half waiting.
There you go.
And when it arrived, I had a real personal wrestle as to whether this was entertaining or whether this was boxing trying to be serious about itself. And the job of a marketeer is to know the audience. And exactly. The audience, whether we like it or not, tuned in by their hundreds of thousands, I believe about 1.2 million pay-per-view buys globally were purchased. In fact, more than the Joshua shock defeat to Andy Ruiz Jr. So that tells you something about what the appetite is of an audience to be seduced by two individuals. I thought Logan Paul could get away with at least looking like a boxer, not KSI. But if I look at some of the numbers that they attracted, I mean, Eddie Hearn sat there without much paid media spend to actually promote a bout because the pair of them were going at it on their own media channels. So what do I think of it? And I've heard a wise man talk about sport needing to be entertaining, not entertainment. On this occasion, I just think it was pure entertainment. Unfortunately, trying to sell itself as something slightly more serious. I think if they just left it as an entertainment spectacle, the Zone were delighted. Eddie Hearn was delighted. I think as a fan, did I enjoy it as a boxing bout? Not really, because I don't really follow those guys on YouTube. I don't really follow them at all. But I couldn't help but wonder if I'm a company and I want to go after that demographic, any one of the 1.2 million people who are going to tune into that, it is a relevant moment in time marketing. But that's all it is. It's a moment in time marketing. Whether it has any endurance to it, if it has a longer tail, I doubt very much. So the number one thing that I worry about with this kind of stunt marketing, if you like, is the short-termism of activity that really promotes more of the same. And I think the industry needs a longer tail, something more enduring. We use the word authentic every single day of the week. Was this authentic? Not really, but it was goddamn entertaining for a couple of hours. And that's what the audience wanted. It was a quick fix of entertainment.
That's what the audience wanted. The audience is where myself, Grant, and Giles probably have a divergence of opinion. I believe the audience is no longer the people on this podcast. The audience for every sport is the people who follow KSI, Logan Paul, Sister James, any of these people who have got millions of followers on YouTube subscription channels. And I just think, you know, forgive me, Andy, you know, like we're all the same age, we're all the same background. But I found that kind of like reminiscent about Beckham to be really old, you know? It's like it struck a little bit like, you know, the days where sponsorship was about exposure and media values. You know, when you said it didn't matter what he said, just what he looked like. I don't think that's the case anymore. You know, it's no coincidence that all the influencers I've mentioned are fast speaking, jive talking, attractive personalities that can make a connection with kids in the language and in the type of delivery that they're used to. And I think that kind of like put some guy on a poster. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in this because I know that people I really respect their opinions of disagree with me, but I just keep coming back to the fact that no matter how much the sports industry talks about this stuff, anytime it says we need to change, I just keep saying times two, times 10, times 100. You don't realise how much you need to change. What do you think?
I agree with you, which sounds weird, given the fact that you might have contradicted the Beckham story. But you must remember, Roger, that was in 2003.
No, I know that. I know that. I just, like, when we were talking about it, I felt like it sounded like, you know, 50-year-old guys talking about, of course, we'll remember David Beckham. But I tell you what, nobody remembers David Beckham. That's what I'm trying to get across, Andy. Nobody remembers football before the Premiership. Nobody remembers football before Ronaldo and Messi. You talk about Fat Ronaldo and they laugh. We think Fat Ronaldo was... Do you know what I mean? We honestly sometimes get caught up in our own TARDIS and this is going to hit us like a brick wall. And all the signs are there, whether you look at e-gaming or whether you look at what we saw with that boxing fight. Sure, it's a joke, but honestly, it's a joke that sells. And at the end of the day, as Jim Kerr was saying to me over the weekend, it's always been called show business, music business. Sports never been called sports business. And that's what I think it's missing. It's now a business.
And I think fans are slowly, not all fans, but slowly coming to terms with the fact that it is a business. I remember turning the pages on the Bolton story, you know, the Burnley story in the summer. And you kind of forget the fact that at some stage, the money's has got to add up and the business has got to basically deliver a P&L that allows the club to remain in existence. And that's about the product. It is to some degree about entertainment, but ultimately it's about the product. And I think the products, when we evaluate things like Logan Paul and our friend KSI, the product at that moment in time was very short term. Will we remember that in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, maybe in 10 months' time? I won't. Will my daughter, both of my daughters, who I spoke about, spoke to them about this afterwards. They knew about it through social media. There was a swipe left immediately. So the short-termism that we're all having to deal with is a real challenge. And the cycle at which we've got to come up with new ideas in the hope that something sticks with the fans, with the consumer for more than 5 minutes, I think it's one of the biggest creative challenges that the industry is facing today, coming up with something that is going to endure
100%.
And actually live in the conscience for more than 5 minutes. And I think, ironically, I think it's making the industry better in so much as we've got to come up with ideas, with better ideas that are creatively driven.
Ideas, 100%.
Let me just jump in because we talk about this a lot on the podcast, Andy, and it's fascinating to hear you talk about this stuff because know, we talk a lot about authenticity and things living in the mind. And I was struck, one of our regular listeners Dominic Henderson out in Japan, who's a dear friend of mine and offers us all sorts of unfiltered feedback, which is always appreciated, sent me a chart this week, which he found in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was. And it just showed the declining rate of engagement with quote-unquote influencers. And whether it be travel, food, lifestyle, fashion, beauty, or sport, from last year to this, the engagement rates have plummeted. And I mean, you know, pretty much halved across every category. So trying to come up with ideas in the short term that will somehow have long-term resonance, I wonder whether that's possible, particularly when you look at something like the ESPN 30 for 30 series, which does a fantastic job in either taking a story or an individual or a combination of both, taking an hour to unfold and unpack that story. And I've seen dozens of those ESPN 30 for 30 documentaries, which I had no idea what the story was. I just know that they're a quality hour to spend. And each one of those stories and each one of those individuals is seared on my brain. I won't ever forget those stories. And I just wonder, is the industry losing itself in chasing the fans down this short-term avenue when it should be perhaps pushing back and going the other way and longer-term content?
And Grant, if I can jump in here, I really agree with that. Is I think as marketeers and storytellers and people who are desperate to create some kind of angle all of the time, I think sometimes we're all in too much of a rush to try and create the kind of just add, you know, sachet and add water to create the amazing product of sport. I take us back to, we talked about tennis earlier. We've just had 18 years of the greatest triumvirate of tennis players who were not a marketing product. They were brilliant, genius tennis players playing five-set tennis in majors, and we will be talking about them for a very, very long time. I take the point of test match cricket. It's dying, they say. And then Ben Stokes does something over the summer, which was transcendent of the sport. So whilst I hear Roger, and I agree to an extent with you, that if you don't evolve, you die, I also think this sort of firm grip, trying to squeeze creativity out of every pore, sometimes you're just left to have genius come out, and it will do.
I agree with that, Giles. I had cause to say in a different forum earlier in the week that Andy's right. You need to come up with ideas. The status quo is stale and it's old. And I find my modus operandi to come out with the best ideas is to open A2 to A3. Because if you play the normal openings, you'll get the same old development. So somebody has to come into the room and shake it up. And you know, I just don't see it as often enough. I'll give you two examples that I'd like you to comment on, Andy. One is British Athletics and the shambles they've got into with their athletes. The second is the Carabao Cup and whether you believe that whoever's advising that that brand, I hope it's not CAA, is doing a good job for them.
Well, let's start with the latter, because, again, if the job of a marketer is to understand audience, whether we like it or not, that is a competition that has had a difficult history, without doubt. Carabao are in a product category that is hopelessly competitive. They now find themselves in bronze medal positions, third only to Red Bull and Lucozade. They were nowhere before they started sponsoring the League Cup. They have secured retailer space courtesy of that sponsorship, retailer space that they would not have gotten if it were not for their long-term investment in the Football League Cup that they've extended, as I understand, to 22. They've got relationships with Reading. They've got relationships with Chelsea. So from a commercial perspective, it is working for them. Now, when I then think, are they adding value to me as a fan of that competition? Do I enjoy the time of the draws being at a time that suits Asia rather than the country where the competition is domiciled? Did I enjoy some of the farces of the early round draws two, three seasons ago, no, I didn't enjoy any of that at all. But in terms of who might be advising Carabao, is it a legitimate platform to help drive awareness and sales of the product in a market that is important to them? It was a good idea. The execution of the sponsorship, over and above the driving of awareness, I would question. But I am coming from the biased stance of having had the privilege of working on that competition for 9 years for Carling. Now, that competition, I know some say is on its backside, but let me tell you about that competition that Carling inherited after its Premier League sponsorship. They inherited a competition that was once the Joker Cola Cup from a brand that was quite steeped in sponsorship, who knew what they were doing, an affront to Coca-Cola, but somehow found themselves in a title named the Joker Cola Cup. Then Worthington, a bitter in football that was unusual, the Worthington Cup became the Worthless Cup. The Carling Cup, it's very rare in our industry, actually, that a sponsor arrives and actually elevates the equity of the property that they've bought. Normally, it's the other way around, or at least parity. Carling arrived and actually introduced the idea of squad. It saved Gerard Houllier's job. I think it was in 2003. He took Liverpool to Cardiff, won when they were in mid-table position on the verge of getting sacked. He won. He got silverware in February. So from a football perspective, I do always have a task to take with people that belittle the Football League Cup. It's a tremendous day out at Wembley. And from a sponsor perspective, yes, it's had a mixed and varied past. Still one of the few naming title sponsorships in football. So if marketed properly, I still think it can deliver tremendous return on investment for the sponsor, and it is for Carabao, whatever we think of their activation. But I've seen better iterations of that sponsorship before. But Carabao, I think they're doing, I would give them a 6 out of 10 so far. Their investment until 22 at least puts them in the game for long term. So they're not smashing and grabbing, which is one of my pet hates in the industry.
And their athletics?
Not as much to say on the athletics, Roger. Okay. What would your view be?
My view would be this. Correct me if I'm wrong, because it's always difficult to get governing bodies and who actually runs the thing. There's always two or three different versions in a sport. Correct me if I'm wrong, but British Athletics, I think, in my mind, and maybe I'm a good example or not, has got this brand over its head now. You kind of knew about Salazar, but you let it go because he was doing so much for you. Next time I hear of this organisation, they're in a fight with their athletes because they've stuck their heels in over sponsorship. Now, running round a track and great athletic performance and all that preparation that these great athletes do, it's got nothing to do with all that. But the only two things I remember about British athletics is the stink of Salazar and the fact that their athletes are mourning that they can't wear their proper kit. I just think that's a 0 out of 10 for me.
Yes, the stigma of these unwanted headlines, and once every 4 years we get the glow of the Olympics, and somehow that doesn't all go away, but it feels a lot better. And from a commercial sponsorship point of view, the bright lights of the Olympics, of which the signature support is athletics, is much more compelling than actually investing in the domestic game. I worked on behalf of one company that chose to exclusively rebrand itself off the back of an athletics program from Norwich Union to Aviva. There was no advertising. There was no sort of above the line spend other than what they'd already invested in athletics. So again, from a commercial sponsorship point of view, the modern industry brings as much reputational threat as it does opportunity. And what you're putting your finger on, quite rightly, are the reputational threats that when a company wants to get involved in sports that do have unwanted headlines, athletics is a good example of that, then they best negotiate a contract that gives them an unambiguous exit. Because there are so many contracts negotiated still in our industry where there is ambiguity as to whether an involvement directly or indirectly in a Salazar saga gives them a rite of passage out. A good sponsor will always give itself a card to say, do you know what? We didn't sign up for this. It is compromising our reputation. And when we hold a mirror up to any partner, we need to see a reflection of our morals and our values. That story doesn't stand up. We are out.
Well, what's very interesting, Andy, what you talk about too, I think that there is a litany of good sponsors who keep rights holders honest. And by that, I mean, if you've got a very strong sponsor that is very clear on its own objectives, clear on using the asset that it has in order to drive awareness, saliency, affinity with the fan, which is what they should be doing, then what I think is interesting is because of the corporate might of big corporations, it tends to get rights holders and governing bodies looking in the right direction. Too often, it's the rights holders who don't have strong corporate backers who find themselves getting slacker and perhaps getting themselves into hot water.
Yeah, I'd agree. I totally agree with that. And isn't it easy in the honeymoon period of negotiating these new partnerships that you overlook the responsibility that both sides have to keep each other honest? And it's an option to terminate. It's an option to walk away. The better sponsor is the sponsor that actually wants to hang around and improve the product. And if there is wrongdoing, if there is foul play, if there is anything that whiffs of something that might harm corporate reputation, I would always sign up to the company that wants to fix the ill and be part of the solution rather than run to the hills.
That is exactly the right thing. I think that the sponsor's role, a good sponsor's role, is to reflect the view of the fan and the public and to keep the rights holder honest. And I've seen that over the years where you've got a really good sponsor who objects to a sport getting it wrong and virtually manhandles the sport into changing governance, changing perception and getting it right. You do that, you're onto that's the role of a good sponsor.
And this is where I have the moral wrestle with the amount of money going into football from the betting industry now. I mean, half of the clubs in the Premier League are sponsored by betting firms. 17 out of 24 club shirts in the Championship showing a betting logo. So that's 27 out of 44 clubs. Now, that's a lot of betting money going into a sport where there are, I think I read a statistic the other day, there are 430,000 adult problem gamblers in the UK alone. 2 million are at risk.
So I'm willing to bet it's more than that.
Well, probably, Grant, probably. The statistics published... So the number that I scribbled down, because I was looking into this the other day as I was sort of pondering whether to advise a betting firm. And the question that I put to them was, can you be part of the solution to eliminate irresponsible gambling? Can you take a stance such as many of the alcohol brands, probably under the stewardship of the Portman Group, that can use the high profile and bright lights of a sports partnership program to look at the elimination of drink driving, a drink responsible campaign? Heineken have done it. Johnny Walker have done it. So the sports of F1 and football have embraced brands that on one side, you've got a lobby that says, how dare they get involved because their product is the cause of many deaths, many addictions, etc. But the attitude of some of these drinking companies is that they will actually promote the message of drink responsibly because there is nothing wrong with having a pint with your friend down the pub talking about the kind of stuff you guys talk about every day. The point is, do it responsibly. And I think there is, again, nothing wrong with having the odd flutter. Do it responsibly. So I would say to half of the companies that sponsor Premier League clubs today, if you're going to go there, make sure that part of your messaging is a messaging that promotes the idea of betting responsibly and being very, very self-aware with money. It could be a financial literacy program. How refreshing would that be that a betting company introduces an activation with a football club that is all about financial literacy, not spending beyond your means? I've seen it from banks. I've never seen that from a betting firm. So when we talk about creativity in the industry, it's that sort of outside of the normal lanes of activation that the industry has to go to. Because, by the way, 50% of the clubs in the Premier League sponsored by betting firms, that's a lot of money to replace. So on the one hand, we can decry the idea of betting companies being so deeply invested in football. But what they don't do very well is actually promote where that money goes. And where that money goes is very much to the pursuance of our enjoyment as fans, helps underwrite signings, improve facilities, training ground facilities, etc. So I think there is a narrative there that they're all missing in this particular category.
Andy, I'd like to come back to you on this because this is a good debate, but one has a duty to put the other side. So earlier you defended Carabao saying it's getting the awareness and the sales. Betting companies yes. clearly are getting a very attractive cost of acquisition of new customers, which is less than the lifetime value of a bettor. So the sponsorship's working for them. So either marketing goes for these, let's call it, very, very practical KPI metrics, or it goes down the route of wider brand values, which you're alluding to there. And this is my problem with Carabao. Carabao may very well have awareness, may very well have retail space, and may very well have sales, but it is associated with a tournament nobody cares about. So hence, they are a drink nobody cares about. You know, so the point I'm making is marketing about getting a result to the bottom, top and bottom line, or is about communicating values for the longer term? It strikes me that companies like Nike are moving to the latter.
I would agree. I disagree that nobody cares about the League Cup anymore, but that's a personal point of view. Carabao have set out their objectives, and their objectives are commercial. My proposition is that a betting firm may well have commercial objectives. They might like to consider another way of acting with corporate responsibility. It's not about philanthropy. It's about acting responsible, acting responsibly as a corporate entity. And the corporate responsibility that Carabao took was, we need to increase our market share in a highly competitive energy drinks market in the UK. What can we do? Our objective was to drive penetration of sales. So the business that we're in often talks about a return on investment. More and more now we're hearing about this notion of a return on objectives. And Carabao's objective was to sell more energy drink, ideally threaten market share, one day maybe become number three behind Red Bull and Lucozade, maybe start to erode their market share to all about the sales. They might find another mode of activation, something that appeals more to the heart and to the fan than the commercial agenda. But today, that's their objective. Betting companies, I don't see them going there in any other way other than to compel me to spend money that I may or may not have in betting and football. So I think I'd like to, at least my start point with this debate is to be greedy. Is there a commercial upside? Is there also a mode of activation where a company can enhance its corporate standing amongst the fans, amongst its staff, amongst its consumers, current and prospective? I would come from the wanted all side of the industry, where we start there. And if we have to reverse back into single-minded objectives that the sponsor requires of its partnership, then that's where we start. Doesn't necessarily mean that's where you've got to finish.
Good answer.
Andy, can I change the subject a little bit? Because on my flight from Zurich to the US yesterday, I sat and finally watched the I think it was Amazon documentary about Leeds United, Take Us Home, Leeds United, which Roger was talking about earlier on, and features one of his heroes in Marco Bielsa. And I'd love to get your thoughts on these, you know, warts and all, behind the scenes, fly on the wall documentaries that we've seen for the All Blacks and Man City and some of the US football teams. But the one thing I noticed about this Leeds United one, and I've enjoyed every single one that I've watched, and I've developed an affinity for the players and the management, and I think it helps you understand the challenges they face. But this series, I realised at the end of it, and this is by no means a knock, and I hope any Leeds United fans listening, A, don't have my address, and B, have very short-term memories. But this was the one that I watched where the connection that I had with the fans of the club was a negative one. And so I wonder, as a sponsor, You know, how much do you have to look at the fan base and decide whether they're actually accretive to money you might be putting into a club?
Well, I'm a Chelsea fan. This is a very difficult one to answer. I love the idea.
Yeah, these fans
not being liked. I'm absolutely on the fifth. I'm with you and everyone else that is in love with these sports documentaries. Something that gets you behind the scenes, the long form storytelling. If I hear the word content again, I'm going to scream. Because everything is over and done in seconds, minutes at best. The longer form that actually gets you behind. I didn't even mind the Man City one. I know lots of friends of mine said, yeah, it was a Middle East PR stunt. It was this, it was that, it was slightly sanitized. But I saw something of Guardiola in that series that I would never have seen if it wasn't for that appetite. And I think the market is now going back. It's almost the back to the future, which is why titles like The Athletic are coming on strong, a return to long form storytelling.
Well, it's now, I call it tantric storytelling. It just takes a long time to get there.
but I think maybe Grant, a Leeds fan, would say, well, we don't care about anyone else. That was a program that was about us, for us. And if you lot watch it and don't like it, well, not sure I care. So one side of the argument could be, back to this A word for authenticity, that the producer of that show has basically made an absolute promise to call it straight and film it straight and not spin it in any other way. Whether me as a Chelsea fan or whoever else I might support watch it and have a love affair with them afterwards or not, from a sponsor perspective, if I sponsor Leeds, I don't really care. If I'm sponsoring football generically, then I've got to be very careful of the very tribal nature of the sport. And there's going to be a whole lot of other clubs and the supporters of those clubs that aren't going to like it as much. So I'm not a Man City fan, but I enjoyed that documentary. I'm not a Sunderland fan, which I think is the best football documentary anyway.
Yeah, agreed.
That I've seen. I don't follow Sunderland at all, but I really associated with that. So if your question is from a sponsor perspective, do they need to be careful? If you're sponsoring the club, as long as it's true to the club and the fans of that club can associate with it, no. If you're a sponsor of football and you just happen to be focusing a light on one club, then you do have to be careful because you don't want to disenfranchise the other 92 clubs, professional football clubs that are out there. So it's a delicate one.
Andy, I wanted to ask you around, you used the word content there, and rightly so. One of my big themes, and this probably comes across a little bit here, it's about if you're in the middle of your thinking, if it's muddled, if it's fudged, you're probably going to do yourself a lot of harm in the world of entertainment, i.e. advertising, same thing, really, same business. The world, I believe in polarization, I call it, and the world's moving to Hollywood blockbusters and art house. It's moving to long form and throw away cheap, meaningless content that works for a fraction of a second. Given all of that, and given your immense experience in English football, where do you see this all panning out? The top six, the top of the championship wanting to break away from the rest of the clubs there. If you had to paint a picture in 5 years' time of what English football looks like, what does it look like?
Wow. Well, I hope we're not talking about a top six. I hope we're talking about a Premier League that is competitive at least down to mid-table. We always refer back to the Leicester City example and look at them now. I love that story of Leicester sort of proving to the world that it wasn't a glorious one-off. In 5 years' time, I promised myself I wouldn't mention the B for Brexit word, but your question prompts a thought about academies, where young talent is going to have to come from, and are we going to see football in 5 years' time more rich in emerging young British talent, English talent? I hope so. as much as I love some wonderful players from overseas that have come over and graced the Premier League, I would love for Gareth Southgate to have a broader spectrum of brilliant young talent from which to choose. He does so now. I think we're on the verge of a lovely new dawn for English football. In 5 years' time, more English players in the starting 11. I support a club where there is a woeful lack of Englishmen start in the starting 11.
Not so much.
Not so much now. And I think, you know, what Frank has done, particularly with Jody Morris, is basically give encouragement to the youngsters coming through. There is no greater cheer at the Bridge than for those young lads being given an opportunity to run out and just enjoy themselves. It's palpable, the feel. This whole breakaway thing, I really hope not. You'll probably know more, Rog, than I about it. But as a football fan, I love the idea of the English clubs playing against the other English clubs, and then the journey away, you know, the trip down to Southampton, the trip up to Newcastle. I like the UEFA Champions League for all of that, of what that brings in terms of the opportunity of travelling overseas to follow your team. But the week in, week out grind of league football, I would like to see a more competitive Premiership that goes beyond top six. And I would like to reduce the amount of yo-yoing that goes on from championships. Then we get into a whole debate about parachute payments and the financing of football clubs, because the teams that go up, teams that go down, you know, you're picking from a very small group. So,
yeah, but I think at that point, we're going to get into not long form content or storytelling. We're going to get into the bloody endless. So let's change tack as we move on.
There you go, Andy. That's the captain when he speaks.
Yeah. So, Andy, I've got a question for you. And I think we do have some younger listeners, so sports marketing wannabes who are at university. And I'm sure for all of us, a lot of people ask, how do you get into the sports industry? How do you get into sports marketing? Question I have for you is that I think many years ago that you had the great pleasure of working for the RFU in a certain capacity, sort of on the pitch, if you could share a little bit about how you can break into sports marketing.
You promised me you wasn't going to go there, Giles Morgan.
I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. It's a great story.
So dearie me. I edited a magazine called Tryline. That was the rugby union equivalent of Shoot magazine back in the day. The RFU had lots of young fans, and the young fans were not being served by a magazine, or very much actually. So we put a magazine idea forward. I ended up becoming the editor of the magazine. One of the competitions in the magazine one day was to send us in Blue Peter style a drawing of the mascot for the England rugby team, because the England team doesn't have a mascot. If they were to have one, what would it look like and what would it be called? The winning design was chosen. It was a rugby ball with arms and legs called Timmy Tryline. We got on. Please don't laugh. This is a serious story. We got on to the business of making it, spent all the bloody money making it, left no money behind to put some poor sod inside of it. So I said, oh, for goodness sake, I'll give it a go. 1.5 seasons later, I still find myself inside of Timmy Tryline going around Twickenham trying to get Mexican waves going before Will Carling led his men out at the old Twickenham. Stood by the tunnel with a walkie-talkie strapped to the cane structure inside, because then, of course, we had somebody in the bowels of the RFU saying the players are about to come out now. That cued me to jump up and down and up and down. And that was really where Timmy Tryline was born. And
do you still have the costume? Killed off by... Do you still have the costume?
No, that was killed off by Brian Moore, because I turned up at the Stoop one day for England training for a pre-publicity stunt. He turned around to Bayfield and said, we're not having that twat running around at our training session. He picked me up and ran me the full length of the pitch at the Stoop, and Bayfield jumped on top of me, and quite how I wasn't speared to death inside that thing, I don't know. But Timmy Tryline was was somewhat injured fatally. And when he was remade, I said, gentlemen, I'll carry on editing the magazine. I'm now retired from being a mascot. So thank you for going there, Giles. That is the terrible story of Timmy Trilane.
Well, Andy, at least you went out on your own terms. That's the one thing. To always go out at the top of your game, you've always got to. If you get that ability, it's a fantastic thing. Listen, we're running out of time, and we've got one more thing we have to do, which is ask our sponsor's question from Smart Sports. And this week we've been talking about marketing. We've been talking about various sports, and the question is there a sport that you see is tremendously undermarketed and offers a great opportunity for the corporate world to get involved and really elevate its place in the world of sport?
Netball is the quick answer to that. Women's football is almost too obvious, and I think there are some early signs of many companies signing up. I think the job that netball has started is prime for future growth. I would say netball is a very smart investment going forward.
What about drone racing, Andy?
I've seen some of that. Oh, in the four. How far in advance are we talking? Drone racing. Do I see that being a big thing? A better man than me will answer that. I wouldn't subscribe to that now.
Well, to be fair, Andy, you could get in a drone. So, I mean, you could actually be a pilot.
maybe drone jockey will actually be drone jockeys. Now this could be a thing, folks.
I think do you know what? I never thought I'd come on this podcast and be inspired from.
I'm trying to picture Lester Piggott on the back of a drone being chased by Steve Cawthon around a challenge, hanging on for dear life. Well, listen, fellas, unfortunately, once again, as always happens, we've run out of time. Andy, this has been just so much fun and so enlightening, I think, for all of us. I'm going to put you on the spot and demand that you come back again. And if you do, I promise we'll ask James to edit out most of that Timmy the Trilane story.
I'm sure James won't, on the insistence of Captain. But it's been a pleasure, gentlemen, genuinely. But
before you go, Andy, if you just let people know how they can maybe follow you on social media if you're active in that space, because I'm sure there'll be plenty of people want to hear some more.
Find me on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, there we go. Andy Sutherland, yes, thank you so much for being just a fantastic guest.
Thanks for being such a sport, Andy. Great stuff.
Cheers,
great
buddy.
Answers.
Cheers.
You're great welcome. Answers.
Thank you, guys.
Well, gents, I've got to say, once again, I've got one eye on the clock and I keep shutting it because I didn't want that one to end. That was so much fun. What a great character, Giles. What a lot of fun Andy was.
Yeah, he's good fun. He's got great stories. He's been around the industry for a long time. And I think it's interesting, the role that he has working for the many sponsors that he works with CAA, and with others during his career, is it's all about storytelling. And we've talked about it a lot in this podcast, is that what brings sport to life, whether we're talking about documentaries, where we're talking about what goes on the pitch or on the screen, is as much about bringing to life about how we all enjoyed it, how the fan enjoys it. And where I think we're well served by people like Andy, Steve Martin is another one who has been a guest on the show, is people who understand that the drama, the humour and the sheer passion that fans have for the sport is what corporates and investors need to understand, like the private equity guys that we were talking about. If you don't understand why and how sport matters to everyday people, it's going to look very dry and corporate. And people like Andy, as you can tell, they've got the humour, they've got the whole piece, which I think is very, very, it's good for the industry.
I think the other thing is, obviously, you know, the one thing I've noticed in common with all the fantastic guests we've had on this show, many of whom have come from, you know, the background of the business side of sports, is that they are fans first. And I think that is the most important thing. You know, I think if the business of sport remains in the hands of true fans, then I think we have a chance to bridge that gap between the two groups and make sure that what the business community is looking to do is consistent with what the fans demand of their sport. Because, you know, what one is simply a numbers game, The other is purely passion, and the two normally don't make for very good bedfellows. But I think, as I say, if you have one group in charge of the other, then you know maybe there's a chance they can stick what is a very, very difficult landing.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I think his answers were, I thought, very, very credible, certainly since some of the questions were probably rather unfair, but that's the way it goes. The sports agency industry has been one of those industries that's had, let's call it, quite an easy life. Let's be very, very honest. I call it gin and tonic man.
Says the man sitting on the lakes of Lake on the side of Lake Como,
sipping a Negroni.
I'm not defending myself. I'm a commentator on the industry, and like so many things in life, but it's anything, whether it's a car salesman, a lot of it was relationship and selling techniques, and the whole industry and the whole marketing world has been built on that. Now, with the use of data and direct to consumer, it is a completely different set of skills. Now, Andy's come up in our generation, but what I saw there is there is somebody that is very aware of how things are changing. I was delighted with, you know, how much he saw in that KSI fight and how you can use that. So I think he's going to be somebody that leads the younger generation to that pragmatic nexus that we all need to find.
Yeah, and Rog, just out of interest, do you know what KSI's KPIs are?
Do you know what KSI stands for?
What the hell do I know?
Well, it's all right. He's sponsored by KFC, so it's fine.
Oh, dear Wyatt. Well, listen, gents, I think that's enough of that. Once we get
down to puns,
I'm going to Macy's, Rog. How about you?
Well, make sure you wear a very nice fitted jacket just in case you get asked back.
I will do my very best. Gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. For those of you listening at home, we hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have. Please, please, please do share the podcast. Tell your friends, tweet, retweet, comment, rate, review, all the things that really, really help us out. And please do try and follow us on social media. You'll find us at Entertained R, that's A-R-E, the word, not the letter. You will find me on social media, should you be so inclined, at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
Oh, is it my turn?
As always, yes.
I have actually forgotten. This is really embarrassing.
Hang on, let me try this. You'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
That's it.
And you'll find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, what can I say? It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. Guys.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.